What's up, Doc?
Welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Schrockerbrot, again with friend and colleague Dr. Joe Palmer. Today, Joe and I really want to talk about thoracic spine, some techniques, what you see in the clinic, and we'll give you our ideas and what we see and what we do for it. So I know the thoracic spine has been looked at research a lot, and I'm sure you look at this research yourself, Joe. And a lot of it has to do now with direct relations to the cervical spine, which is understandable. Restrictions in the T-spine can definitely cause compensation in the cervical spine, but it goes a little bit further than that, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I see that a lot in patients in the clinic where the postural dysfunctions as well as joint hypomobilities in the thoracic spine can lead to not just problems in their cervical spine, but they end up having compensation mechanisms that go into the shoulder. And I'll say occasionally further down the arm. I find that the further away you go, the less likely it is to be the main cause, but definitely a contributing factor. And so that's why it's important that we don't neglect it and that we explain to the patient, I think, why we're looking at it so that they understand as well.
That's definitely a good point. I know personally I see a ton of these, and I have a lot of physicians refer to me just because I love looking at the thoracic spine and a lot of these issues that, you know, I get patients that have been to several other therapists before they get over to my clinic, and I see them, and, you know, the thoracic spine gets ignored. Patients with shoulder issues, especially athletes, or even as far as the elbow, you see a lot, especially in throwing athletes. So what you can picture is imagine the thoracic spine, just like any other joints in your vertebrae, you have flexion, you have extension motions. So as a throwing athlete, let's say baseball player, for example, as a baseball player winds up to throw, the shoulder flexes and abducts, right? But for that to happen, your thoracic spine also has to extend on that same side. So if that, let's say a right-handed thrower, as they wind up, bring their arm back, if the thoracic spine of two, three of those facets are stuck in a flexed position, you essentially have the shoulder overextending itself or overflexing itself to create that force generation, and it will eventually wear away, whether it's rotator cuff, the labrum, it's going to happen somewhere. Right.
It definitely plays a big part in the scapulohumeral rhythm, and if you're not getting that extension, then you're right. You're exactly right. It's going to have to be compensated for at the scapula, and maybe it's not. Maybe that's what's causing some of your impingement type symptoms that your patients may be presenting with.
Well, yeah, I definitely agree. There is very quick, you know, it's a pretty quick assessment, not to say not detailed, but it could be fairly quick to do, is, you know, you assess the thoracic spine after you did your normal screen, you know, strength, motion, see if there's any radicular symptoms, paresthesias, all that stuff to clear the C-spine, obviously. But when it comes down to, you know, you do your, let's say it's a shoulder pain patient, you check your shoulder, you do your normal motion, strength, test the ligaments. And then, you know, a lot of times they might have a positive labral test, a labral stress test. That's fine, right? You're not really, if they have a positive test, you really, at that point, you're not really concerned of what they have. You want to know why they have it, because you want to fix it and you want to make sure it doesn't happen again. I know that's at least my mindset when I find these things. And what I see a lot of times is I will find a thoracic dysfunction in that area as well. Now, if you find something, you know, that's doesn't really correlate, then you make your best clinical judgment whether to manipulate or not. But if it's a direct correlation between the cause that you think is putting stress on that shoulder, I generally manipulate it. Again, most times that's a path of mechanical end feel, or jammed, and it calls for manipulation. What do you usually do?
I do as well. Tell you what I also like to do is talk about their posture. I just not necessarily in a throwing athlete. Let's talk about you know, 50-year-old male that works at a desk, and I definitely want to make sure that I'm promoting postural awareness, and that I'm giving him some range of motion type exercises that he can do at home in order to increase his regular joint mobility on a daily basis. And if he does that, this is after I fix the dysfunction that I found. If the joint is jammed and stuck subluxed, then you want to manipulate to fix that. But I want to give them something that they can take control and try to continue that mobility at home, because a lot of what I see, as far as flexion subluxations, is just based on the fact that everything that we do in life is in front of us.
I agree and disagree at the same time. It's a skill. I definitely think that there's definitely a component to it. It's just when I hear, and I know it's the term more than anything, but anytime I hear posture, that just becomes a pet peeve of mine, because I think a lot of times most of us use posture as a diagnosis. And I know you don't do this as often, and it's not exactly what you're talking about, but I know more times than not I hear bad posture. People diagnosed, oh, you have bad posture, so this is why you have this. It's bad posture. Well, you know, what the heck is bad posture? When have you ever seen bad posture as a medical diagnosis anywhere? It's always what's within that posture that you have to fix, right? You have to break it down, and you have to see what, you know, somebody that's, in your example, let's say 50-year-old that's been working at the office for 30-some years, and they've been pretty good for 20 of those years or 25 of those years or even, you know, 29 years and a half until they came to see you, and they've been okay. Then all of a sudden, 6 months ago, their posture went bad. So that's what I have a hard time with. I agree with you that once you have to fix the dysfunction, whatever caused that flexion dysfunction, I don't necessarily agree it's a posture thing, but it might just be a semantics that we're divided at.
I think so, because the reality is we'll never know what caused the dysfunction. But if I can, while they're there, make suggestions that they can give that joint a better chance at performing the job that it was supposed to perform, whether that caused it or not. If he slept on a rock, and that caused it, well, I'm just going to hope that he didn't sleep on the rock again. But if it's something that happens every day, I want to try to influence that while he's with me, getting treatment for his symptoms.
That's a fair point. In my opinion, I don't think there's no such thing as good posture. There's no such thing as good static posture, at least. I think with dysfunctions like these in the thoracic spine, even after you fix them, if they sit or stand or just are in a position for X amount of time, and everybody's different, I think eventually there's going to be some kind of regression. I think that the best thing that's available to these people, and this is what I recommend to my patients all the time, is get up and move around every 5 or so minutes, every 10 minutes. And that doesn't mean, you know, do laps around your office, but just 30 seconds, you know, flex, extend your spine, do little rotations, just little motions, just to get that neurophysiological input into that joint, because that's what is really going to keep it there after you manipulate it, right? That's kind of the big difference between us and chiropractors. You can make a case for is we find a joint that's dysfunctional, we fix it, but then we add that extra layer of neurophysiological retraining to make sure that the nervous system adapts to it and the body is able to maintain whatever you gave them.
I agree. Essentially, we're saying the same thing. I'm trying to give them techniques and exercises that they can keep that joint moving and keep the input going. And you're saying the same thing with your patients. Don't sit in that position for an extended period of time. So
let's back up a little bit and let's get back to the clinic. So the patient comes in and you did your assessment and you definitely know at this point that the thoracic spine is involved. So you do your PPAVMs, so accessory motions, intervertebral motions. And let's say at the T3-4 segment, the right facet is not extending. So you have a extension hypomobility or flexion subluxation. After that point, what do you usually do?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is talk to the patient about their options. My preferred technique is a derotational manipulation with a pistol grip, patient supine, and you're applying a P to A force, but it's going through the patient's chest into your hand with a block on the lower segment, causing the rotational component to that correction. Now, if the patient is not ready for that, that's kind of the basis of the buzzword of evidence-based practice. You want to make sure that the patient's beliefs are in line with the techniques that you're doing. I explained to him that I think this is the best technique supported by the literature for correcting that subluxation. And then I let them tell me, what they're comfortable with.
Right. Very fair. So you go through, obviously, the usual. Even before that, you want to screen to make sure the manipulation is safe. So thoracic spine manipulations are not as life-threatening as potentially cervical spine or vertebral artery issues, but you still want to screen, make sure they don't have any bone issues, bone density issues.
They also shouldn't be on blood thinners, right. Anticoagulant therapies.
Right, exactly. So you go through that, you make sure osteoporosis, osteopenia even. So a lot of times I know I get this, asked this, is when is your cutoff age for joint manipulation? And I really don't have a cutoff age. It's obviously use your best clinical sense, but you can have a 67-year-old that's in great condition, or you can have a 50-year-old that's nowhere near that condition. I know a lot of literature cuts it off at around 65, and I don't think that's very fair to a lot of your patients. So I definitely use the best clinical sense, but as you said, you make sure that you clear blood thinners, anticoagulants, bone issues, and then you get into the more of the psychosocial components, right? Kind of what you were alluding to is make sure they understand that this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen to your joint. You might hear a pop or a cavitation. Or you might not, but there's always that risk for what's called post-manipulative soreness the next couple of days, where your joint goes from a position of being locked down in a position of flexion or extension, and then all of a sudden has a lot more freedom to move around, and that's not always a comfortable thing for the system to catch up to.
I completely agree. When you talk about that with patients, most of the time, I feel like they're very receptive, and typically, when I approach it from that manner, when it's all said and done, they actually don't understand why I made such a big deal out of it. They enjoyed the manipulation. They feel the increase in range of motion right away. But I think that's still the safest way when you're clinically practicing.
Right. So let's jump back to the technique itself. You call it a derotational, which is definitely understandable and one way to look at it. I'll give another perspective on it, and I look at these more strictly biomechanical. So I strictly think flexion or extension. So the derotational component obviously adds rotation to it, and that's more into the FRSRs, the RSRs, kind of that muscle energy way of thinking of it. The other way is just biomechanical, which is flexion or extension. So if the set that's not extending, it's stuck in a flex position, right? If you have a right side bending motion, that's essentially creating extension on the right facet. So when I have patients supine, I will side bend them to the right to take the joint to its end range extended position. When I feel that, that's when I'll apply the thrust through the opposite or the posterior segment on the left. And to picture it, to give that a clear picture, is you have the joint on the right flexed, which is, just for the sake of imagery, it's kind of superior or forward, so to speak, which creates a posterior position on the left side. So the thrust usually happens through that posterior segment, and that's what my knuckle will thrust through. Now, do you ever get cases or patients when you do that thrust and you just bounce back? It just doesn't go.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you're doing that, there are certain scenarios where the patient is either not relaxed, letting it go, or you have looked at it, you've assessed it, and maybe you think you have a flexion subluxation, but in essence, you may have a lateral subluxation instead.
Now that's a good point. You brought up lateral subluxation or transverse subluxation, as they're sometimes known. How does that change the biomechanical testing or the objective test, and what do you do for it?
Well, when you're looking at a lateral or transverse subluxation, you should have both of your facets in either a flexed or extended position. P pivums and P pavums should both be abnormal on either side. And how it changes your treatment is that you want to promote a distraction at that joint to allow it to reset, rather than trying to force a straight flexion to, or flexion or extension to one side of that facet. Essentially, both facets are subluxed, and if you are trying to push on one to move the other at that point in time, you're gonna bounce out and not be able to complete the manipulation.
Right, and this is a pretty tough assessment. And if you've never learned about these transverse subluxations or lateral subluxations, this would be pretty hard to visualize as we're talking about it. And if you want to see more of a visual, let us know. Leave us a comment on the website, therapyinsiderspod.com, or shoot us an email. The quickest way is to leave a comment on iTunes, and we could definitely make a quick video show you guys.
And as we talk about assessment for the technique, and then actual treatment of a distraction manipulation in the thoracic spine, it's the nuances of that technique, direction of thrust, and hand positioning are all very hard to describe, especially in a podcast. So definitely send us an email. Let us know that you're interested in the technique. Let us know what your experiences have been, and we'll certainly get back to you on that.
Yeah, because it's definitely fascinating, and it's very, very useful and helpful if you ever try to manipulate and it just kind of bounces back at you. But what essentially happens is the entire segment shifts over, left or right, meaning you have, let's say we're at T3, 4, T3 shifts over on T4, right or left, and that also brings the rib joints with it. All right, so you have more than just the facet joints that are involved now. Now, when Joe says distraction, there's several forces, the directions of thrust, kind of what Joe was saying, that it's pretty tough to visualize, and it's very, very tough to explain. But you have the facet plane thrust, which we talked about earlier, is you side bend the trunk to the end feel position, and then you thrust through the joint. That's the least amount of stress on the joints because you're going through the facet plane. Then you have another thrust, which is a traction thrust or superior thrust, where you're going just in the caudal, in the cranial direction. And then you have a third thrust, which is, if I had to put a number on it, probably not more than 90% of the therapists are doing, is the distraction thrust, where it's straight AP thrust. And that actually puts the most amount of stress on the joints, and that should be the last manipulation you're doing. That's when everything else doesn't work anymore, because that is a non-physiologic plane. That is what we're usually taught at school, that's what all chiropractors do, and that is the highest amount of post-manipulative soreness that your patients are going to experience. So if you have a straight facet limitation, you should be doing that facet thrust first. If you bounce back, meaning when you try to thrust, you don't have a cavitation, the joint just bounces into your hand, there's absolutely no motion happening after that technique, then you figure out if there's a transverse subluxation, and then you do a superior thrust. Just literally, you have your knuckle and your thenar eminence on T4, so then the thrust goes to through T3, and it goes superior and resets itself on T4. Again, that's still a physiologic thrust, because traction is a motion that doesn't stress your facet joints. Now, if all that fails, then you have your last distraction thrust, where you're just thrusting T3 straight down to the table on T4. And it's effective, but it's a lot more general. It's not as specific as the other two. And I know my patients, out of all the techniques, that's the one they'll have some soreness with.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point with the progression. You want to make sure that you're using the least aggressive technique to get the job done.
I know after the manipulation, I usually have the patient lie down prone and do some grade 3 or so wobbles through the thoracic spine just to get that neurophysiologic input into the joints again. And I know that usually reduces a little bit of the post-manipulative soreness in my experience. And then, you know, I sit right back up and I retest that shoulder motion. And I still haven't had a patient that I didn't see at least some improvement on after that thoracic manipulation.
In addition to that, I'm getting back to, I'll have him do some thoracic extensions. I'll have him do some press-ups. I want them to be in control of the extension as well. So I'll do your grade 3, and then I want to make sure that they can control that new range of extension as well.
Absolutely. I definitely have thoracic extension programs going after those manipulations. If they're limited into extension, that's part of the treatment. I never just manipulate and let them go, right? That's more of a chiropractic approach that we tend to not to follow, because our job is to restore function, right? We don't really, as insensitive as this may sound, and I actually say this to patients, is I don't really care about your pain. You know, it's a means to an end. Obviously, I want to get rid of it. I want to know what's causing it. But my job is not to make you painless or pain-free. My job is to get rid of that pain so you can do X, Y, and Z. And that's what you have to do. The techniques are just a means to an end.
I agree. And I think that if you're not looking at the thoracic spine, now's a good time to start. If you have been, and you're interested in some of the techniques that we talked about, then you need to send us an email.
Yep, or more importantly, leave us a comment on iTunes. Let us know you're listening, and we'll get back with whatever information you want to see. Soon to come, we're going to have some articles posted on the website as well, therapyinsiderspod.com. That's P-O-D. And we're going to cover some of these techniques that we talked about and some other upper extremities that joints that are involved. So today we kind of talked about the shoulder, but the elbow gets involved as well, something called abducted ulna. That's very problematic. And but we need to hear your feedback, so let us know what you think. iTunes, again, you can search physical therapy. You can search Therapy Insiders. We'll pop right up. Quickest route, therapyinsiderspod.com. Click the link to iTunes. Leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. Coming up after a little break, you'll hear Jim Meadows' part two interview where he discusses more some of joint manipulations that we talked about. And he gets into some more detail-oriented information that I think you guys will like to hear, especially if you like part one. So this is Gene Chirac-Abrad and Joe Palmer again.
Thanks for listening.
We'll see you guys in a week or so.
So, Jim, you've practiced in multiple countries. Where do you see the future of PT in the United States heading right now?
Well, okay, let's get it accurate. If we're talking about multiple countries, we're talking about England, Norway, Canada. I do spend a lot of time in the States, but not practicing. I teach a lot in the US. So having said that, what's your question again?
Where do you see the future of PT in America?
Particularly orthopedics.
Well, I think actually, as far as manual therapy is concerned, I think this country has a lot of potential, providing it's not crushed. IOMT was formed in 92, I think. That's IFOMT. I mean, US got entry into IFOMT extremely late. IFOMT's been around since 76, it might be earlier. But the US, for its country as important and numerous as this is, to get into it that late shows you how much little interest there was in the country organization wanting to get into it. Stanley Parris really pushed this. So you're in now, and AOMP's doing a good job of fellowship control. There's an awful lot of educational groups that are producing fellows for AOMPT. So providing the impetus continues, I can only see it getting better and better. One of the problems I've got, and I have to say this, is the overemphasis, not on evidence, but on a particular type of evidence. Medicine will tell you that evidence consists basically of research evidence and the literature that goes with that. A social framework to work within and experience. And what I'm seeing coming out of academics, not all of them, but a large number of them, is basically that experience is very, very, very low on the scale of evidence. And I don't think you can dismiss it that lightly. And particularly as most of the evidence that's being produced by researchers is either weak, it may well be scientifically rigorous, often it isn't, but it's weak in as much as the relevancy for the clinician. I don't see an awful lot of research that is clinically relevant to me that helps me understand what I'm doing or treat patients better. And I'm not a Luddite. I like progress, I like new things, but I just don't see this. Now, it'll improve, hopefully, but right at the moment, I think it's squashing the life out of clinicians who want to just work. And they're being held, they're bashing, a lot of these people now, especially in the newer grads, are almost scared not to practice only what has been researched. at the same time, I also think you need to be wary of authority figures telling you what works. And I think there needs to be a skepticism on both sides. But I do think we need to swing this back where your experience, other people's experiences counts for a fair amount. Because right now, the amount of research out there isn't there. And if you only teach research-based evidence, I think the school program could be done in 3 months. There just isn't enough research that would allow a good clinician to work solely from the research levels.
I think research is very wide and over the place. And, you know, orthopedics, I think the most research and probably the easiest research thing is therapeutic exercise. So you see exercises being performed a lot. But in PT, and especially in orthopedics, you know, we work with joints, we work with soft tissues. Obviously, we do exercise. So if somebody does exercise, what is the model to follow? Is it more of that sports model, or is it more of a neurologic nervous system retraining?
The way I look at it is that specific retraining for an event, an occupation, is retraining. To get to that point, you need rehabilitation. I don't see these as being the same thing at all. To be honest with you, I've got pretty much no interest in retraining programs. My interest stops at rehab. So if I can get the patient to the point where they can now retrain, by all means, somebody else should do that. Somebody who knows the job or the activity inside out is probably your best bet to do this. So I think mostly the exercises that we should be looking at as far as rehab is concerned, these people need to regain neurophysiological control of their bodies. So I see this as being neurophysiological exercise, as it were. And I think they should be neurologically based. And I think as much as possible, we shouldn't, as orthopedists, be trying to reinvent the wheel by making our own exercise. I mean, the neurotherapists have lots of experience at this. And we've got an easy job because we simply have to increase tone in muscle when they're hypotonic due to inhibition. We don't have to worry about decreasing spasticity. So we've got it fairly easy. And I think that's really where we need to push this. In fact, one of the teaching groups, IPA, is very much PNF based. I think probably I don't emphasize it enough. I cover it, but I don't emphasize it enough because I figure of all the things that can be taught in school, exercise, specific exercise prescription, should be. So my expectation is they can do it. I'm often disappointed, but essentially though, it's a manual therapy program, and exercise, while not secondary, can't be a major component of the class if we don't want to extend the course. But I think it's really important, and my preference would not be a sports medicine model because most of my patients are not athletes.
So the big push right now with exercise is, and I guess the buzzword is functional. Functional exercises, functional retraining. And it kind of sounds like that's what you're talking about. Do you find what the movement pattern is? It's just there's no, in my opinion at least, there's no clear definition of what functional retraining is.
No.
You know, some people say as long as you're doing weight-bearing exercises, you're doing functional exercises, and I don't necessarily agree with that. PNF, you can make a case for that's functional retraining because you're doing movement retraining, a movement pattern that your body should do.
Or define function. Well, I mean, until you've got a clear definition of function, you really can't talk about function. And function means different things. Is function going back to work, or is function getting out of the bed? I mean, if function is anything you do in your daily life, then pretty much everything is functional. If it's about a specific activity, then no, I'm guilty of that. I won't do functional work because I'm not interested in specific activities during the rehabilitation phase. So you need, what we don't do very well is these types of debates is actually define what we mean. It would make it so much easier if we did.
To me, functional is the combination of the components that lead up to the actual task that you want to perform. So to me, when I'm doing a PNF, I'm not using that as a functional task. That's a retraining step in a functional process for me. So,
as I say, if you define terms, then we can debate it. But if you don't define the term and just state the term, you can't have a reasonable, rational conversation.